John, you are talking about imperialism and its relevance today.
Yeah, well, all I was pointing out there was how this the evidence for its continued existence is so overwhelming when you actually look at how sort of wealth income is distributed between countries. You find that it matters more, it matters as much at least which country you're born in as which class you're born in. The differences are really quite continue to be extreme, and there's been a lot of talk about convergence between rich and poor countries, and a lot of talk about imperialism as if it's something in the past. And yet, there's no evidence that it's there's some evidence since the turn of the year 2000 when you put China into the picture. You take China out of the picture where so much of the growth in the global south has come, including growth in income. You take China out of the picture and look at the whole of the rest of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And you find income stagnation in most of those countries. And if you look beyond the last 10 years, which have been quite exceptional, because while the global financial crisis was taking place, Africa, Asia, and Latin America were actually receiving, were experiencing the highest rates of growth that they'd experienced since World War II, which is quite amazing while a global financial crisis was raging. A lot of that was to do with hot money fleeing rich countries and looking for a quick return in the global south. And the what's called the commodity super cycle, the price they were getting for their raw materials started going up instead of down, which is its usual direction. So they did well for the last 10 years while the West rich countries were stagnating. But for most of the time in the last 40 years, rich countries have grown faster than countries in Africa, Asia, and much Africa, Latin America, much of Asia. So no sign of convergence. And the gaps are absolutely stark, and they've been revealed by the coronavirus crisis. If we get around to showing my slides, I'll show you one slide which shows that something like if you look at how much government has been spending to mitigate the effects of the coronavirus crisis on their population, turns out that rich countries are having something like 3,500 times more spent on mitigating the effects of the coronavirus crisis than the average citizen of a poor country. I mean, the differences are so grotesquely extreme. I think it's, that it shows the continued existence of imperialism. One last thing I'll just say is that I find it very useful to imagine a cup of £2.50 coffee that you buy in a shop. One penny of that goes to the coffee farmer. Just one penny of it. And that doesn't even cover the cost of their production in many parts of the world. And you can see there how much wealth is being extracted from farmers. Something like you need something like 800,000 farmers working year round to produce the coffee that is consumed in the United Kingdom. Imagine that. Nearly a million poor farmers spend their entire lives because we consume something like 3.5% of the global coffee, and there's 25 million farmers. So if you go and divide, work out what 3.5% of 25 million coffee farmers are, you get something like 800,000, and they are living starving in poverty. They can't afford to pay their medical bills. They can't afford to send their kids to school. In fact, they need their children as child labor to bring in your coffee. And yet, and that's the people who grow our coffee now. Coffee farmers' lives matter. When we talk about Black Lives Matter and the fantastic mobilizations around the world, especially in the United States after the murder of George Floyd, the whole of the left and many, many liberals as well are all trying to make out that we all acknowledge the history of colonialism and slavery and neocolonialism and the legacy that remains to be addressed, the legacy of the past, legacy of 19th century and 20th century colonialism and neocolonialism. What about 21st century neocolonialism? What sections of the left actually have pointed to continued imperialism, not just the legacy of the past that we are thankfully hearing about, because it's better that we acknowledge the legacy of past colonialism rather than ignore it. as we have been doing for most of the past, well, I guess 150 years. So I think there's a lot of denial in imperialist countries about imperialism and a lot of problems with outdated conceptions. Imperialism is often identified with colonial possession. That is really just the form. The content of imperialism is always to try and take the wealth, the natural wealth and the living labour of the colonised country. And if you can do that without actually physically occupying the country, and if you can create a sort of an elite that will share the reins of power with you and share the spoils with you, then that's a much more economical way than acceptable these days way of conducting your affairs. So, but the issue of the coffee farmers, which could be duplicated for so much else that is produced in poor countries that we consume, really points to the continued existence of imperialism as an important factor. So there's my answer to that question.
No, very much, John. Unfortunately, everyone, we had technical difficulties, so sincerest apologies for that. John, you have some slides to show as part of the
plan. Do you want me to actually show the seize the screen and show the slides then?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, then. Well, I'll share my screen in that case, which means I'll probably go invisible, but that doesn't matter at all.
No problem.
Host disabled participants. I think the host has to make it possible for me to share my screen. Okay, well, you do that then. That's what I was expecting, but I don't mind either way. At the moment, I don't see any slide on the screen. Should I not? Ah, I see. Okay. Does that mean none of you can see it either? All right, okay. Here we go. Okay, so slide one. Well, that's got the a little kind of a design I made. But just to explain the term, I don't like using fancy words that nobody's ever heard of, and climacteric is probably one of those sorts of words. So this is like just a working title for this evening. But I just thought, on the other hand, when I was putting the title together, that the term crisis just doesn't seem to do justice to the situation that we're in on a global scale at the moment. I mean, there are multiple crises, and any one of them you could say is of an enormous magnitude. Just think of the economic crisis, the medical crisis, or the ecological crisis, and there are many others. So it seems like we need new words to describe the new situation that we're moving into. But there is one word which I came across. Climacteric, which means a watershed, a turning point, a critical period or event. And this period that we're in, and maybe even this year, 2020, is really turning into a climacteric, a watershed crisis, actually coming to a head, not just a crisis that's just chronic. We're all used to chronic crises. We're going to have to get used to a different type of crises in the world that we're moving into. And also it helps as well to introduce if you put the second slide on, a really great article, which I strongly recommend, and you'll see the URL to it there. John Bellamy Foster, the editor of Monthly Review, and he wrote an excellent article that I would recommend, and that's where he reintroduced the word climacteric into the lexicon. So I borrowed from that. So what I want to do with this talk, and I'll keep a close eye on the time, and if I don't get to the end of what I want to do, that's too bad, I guess. I'll just stop. But we should be able to have a conversation anyway. There's two basic things I want to do. One is to sound the alarm, and also to issue a call to arms about a new debt crisis in the so-called emerging market countries, and about the criminal inaction of the G7 rich countries when faced with a severe crisis that has been brought on by the was being exacerbated, has been brought down on their heads by the coronavirus crisis, but very much was very much there and wreaking its havoc in poor countries before the coronavirus even hit. So that's the first thing, is to talk about that. And then the second is to try and stand back a little bit from the crisis that we're in the middle of at the moment and look at it in a bit of a historical and global perspective, to try and be able to get a better handle on it, to try and get a sense of the magnitude of the crisis, to get a sense of the importance of this moment in a longer, larger time span, because this is, I believe, a very special moment. And also to look at how a couple of these key indicators are actually connected together. In particular, we all know we're now living in a world of negative interest rates, and interest rates have been declining for a long time. And it turns out that why interest rates are so low and the role they're playing at the moment is extremely important for all kinds of things. So that's what I'll try and explain a few things about in the second part of my talk. And that will basically take easily fill up the 15 of the 25 of the 30 minutes that I set out to do. So if you could move it on to slide 3, please. Okay, so we have a pretty dramatic picture there. I mean, you're all used to seeing graphs. I mean, graphs can be very interesting. I mean, they are. What's so good about a graph is that it can show how things move in time. And so most of these graphs will actually show the picture of the last 20 years or maybe the last 5 years. And you can see where we are at the moment. And there we are, a global economy on the cliff edge. I don't need to remind you all about the very sharp decline in GDP and growth all around the world. If we move on to the next slide, you can see here that one of the remarkable things about the first phase of the COVID crisis was how, even before coronavirus had even made its appearance in Africa or Latin America, the economic shockwave of its arrival in Europe had already exerted an enormous impact. Most of Latin America and other countries actually started locking down even just as the crisis was hitting, but it still spread because of their lack of possibilities. But you can see here in this graph anyway the how much more severe the economic shock of the arrival of coronavirus in Europe and North America was for the southern nations. And if you move on to number 4,
feel free to...
So the next one is number 5, which shows the developing economies face varying hit from coronavirus pandemic. So this shows here how Latin America has, for various reasons, been much more badly hit both economically and medically by the coronavirus crisis. Okay, if you could skip on, just go straight through the next one and then go to the one that says the great reversal at the top, please.
Feel free to take as much time as you need.
Okay.
All nope. Right. You're all.
Okay, well, so what we have, therefore, is a picture that was rapidly developing by April, May of this year, that poor countries, the coronavirus was just starting to take off. But already they'd had a dramatic economic hit, the worst hit they'd received in their living memory. Simultaneously, a massive exodus of wealth, capital flight, investors just withdrawing their money in a panic on a scale that's never been seen in history. And then at the same time, a big decline in remittance flows from those among their number who have found work in rich countries, also a collapse of the tourist industry, a collapse in their currencies as well, which made foreign debt more expensive. All of these things all hit the countries all at the same time, plus also a collapse in the price of raw materials, because with the expected economic slump. The future prices of raw materials just fell through the floor. In fact, if you remember, oil even went into negative territory. You could actually get somebody to give you money to take oil off their hands at one extreme moment. And since then, rich countries have spent a huge amount, most nearly all of it borrowed, in order to try and finance, to try and put some kind of a cushion under the economy and stop it collapsing completely. They've spent a gigantic amount of money, as you all know. That $8 trillion, that was as of May 23rd of this year. It's since been exceeded, and there's plenty of talk about further multi-trillion dollar packages being needed in order to sustain the economy until, in inverted commas, it actually starts to fire and move forward by its own engines. And really, the global crisis, the global economy went into the coronavirus crisis before there's ever anybody had ever heard of the word coronavirus. Just 10 months ago, went into this crisis already in intensive care. And we all know that coronavirus wreaks havoc on systems, organisms, which have underlying health conditions. Well, the global financial crisis, the global capitalist economy was suffering from underlying health conditions on a grand scale. In fact, as I say, they were really in intensive care, only kept alive by massive injections of quantitative easing, by interest rates that are lower than they've ever been in history, in negative territory. We can perhaps come on to discuss the importance of that. That was before the crisis hit. But since then, they've spent a huge amount of money, massively going further into debt, in order to try and prevent the shockwave of the economy causing complete collapse, from which they'd not be able to get up off the floor. So if you move to the next slide. The real thing I want to bring across here, and this is the most important part of part one of this talk, is to show how much that contrasts with the situation in poor countries, countries without powerful central banks, countries without hard currencies. And what we find there is that the G20, well, what is the G20? The G20 is the rich countries, and they now meet often with leaders of India, China, Mexico, a whole range of other countries, Brazil, South Africa. But really, when they talk about G20 countries making decisions, it's really the G7 countries that make decisions. Others just participate. When it comes to deciding what to do about the third world debt, about debt owed by poor countries, it's very much the G7 nations. They're the ones that call the shots. So I'm just prefacing the first line of this. The rich countries, the G7 countries hiding in the G20, have frozen official loan payments from low-income countries until the end of 2020. Just to explain that, low-income countries, there's about 120 and a large number, many of them very small countries, of poor countries called least developed countries. The only countries in Latin America which are actually considered to be least developed countries is Honduras, Bolivia, Guyana and Nicaragua. All of the rest of those countries in Latin America are not part of that list, such as Peru, Ecuador, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia. These least developed countries, many of them in Africa, were granted the permission by the G7 rich countries to apply for a postponement of their interest payments until the end of 2020. Not a cancellation of interest payments, just a postponement of interest payments, and they would have to pay interest on the on this postponement. Not only that, the most important thing here is that this would only apply to the money which they owed to official creditors, such as the World Bank or individual governments. The private sector was left completely out of the picture, and yet it is the private sector who these poorest of poor countries actually owe their money to, owe most of their money to. So the intention when these package was announced back in April was to put pressure on the private sector for them to follow suit and to also postpone, delay until the end of this year their payments, the servicing of their debts. These people are loan sharks. I mean, who goes to the poorest parts of town to lend money to people who are most hard up? They're the loan sharks. These are the people who the least developed countries owe most of their money to. And as you can see from this editorial in the Financial Times, there was concern expressed at the time that any generosity given to poor countries for the loans to official creditors would have the perverse, you might say, effect of freeing up their cash to pay off the private creditors. In other words, the effect of any generosity by the official creditors is to basically bail out the private creditors and ensure that they can keep getting their money without a day's delay and without a cent or a penny knocked off it. We talk about the poorest countries on earth who need every penny they've got in order to cope with the coronavirus and to cope with the biggest economic hit they've ever experienced in their living memory. So that is the extent of the generosity of the rich countries. And they've been debating it since. And incredibly, they still haven't agreed to roll over or to extend their postponement of debt servicing until the end of this year. The proposal is, and they probably will agree to it, is to roll it over so they can have another 6 months or 1 year holiday from having to pay their cash. So if we just move on to the next slide. That's one there, reports there, how reports from the International Labour Organization showing the absolutely mind-boggling, stunning impact of the crisis on working people, on the poor majority of Latin America and Africa in particular, but the same is true in India and Indonesia and many, many other countries. And it reported here that in the first month of the crisis, income of informal workers fell by 60% globally, with a drop of more than 80% in Africa and Latin America. Now, the informal workers, that is half of the entire working class of this planet. Half of all workers fall into the category of informal workers, and that includes those in the rich countries. In poor countries, informal workers are even bigger, more than half. And they're the ones who are already on the lowest level of income above subsistence, and they've suffered during that terrible second quarter of this year a 60% or even 80% drop in their living standards, in their income. And in many places, it's hardly begun to recover. So if you move on to the next slide. So that just reports the devastating economic impacts. And if we move on to the next slide. So I showed you the editorial from the Financial Times, talking about the mass starvation of people in poor countries and the role of rich investors in leeching every single penny they can from these countries, despite the fact that there's a pandemic raging. Despite such an editorial, they printed nothing about it for the next 3 or 4 months. No more editorials, hardly any articles about this. Every now and then a little whisper, no scandal about the way the rich countries are treating the poor countries as they try to deal with this gigantic pandemic and an economic collapse on top of that. But then we find, just in the last few days, an article reappears in the Financial Times showing that behind the scenes there's been pressure being put. Okay, so there hasn't been much fuss in the newspapers. Certainly our politicians haven't made much of a fuss about it. Why not? Why haven't they told us that this is the way that the central bank in the way the Bank of England has behaved? Well, I find it scandalous that this is hardly known in the rich countries. Anyway, I'm referring to this article here in the Financial Times from just a few days back. And this is a quote from David Malpass, the World Bank's Director General. Okay, Director General of the World Bank, David Malpass. He was actually nominated by President Donald Trump, and he was Chief Economic Advisor to Trump's election team in 2016. So I wouldn't write him off completely, because despite that fact, he's come out with a fairly forthright statement here as World Bank Director. And the headline of the article is really hyping things up. World Bank piles pressure on private creditors. Well, the World Bank Director General has just let it be known that he's extremely upset. But I don't know about piling pressure on private creditors. They don't dare touch these people. They might plead or make occasional statements, pleading with them to show some generosity. But they don't put any pressure on these people. Anyway, so far, whatever you can say about whether they do put behind-the-scenes pressure, they have not budged an inch. There's not been the slightest sign of any movement towards following what the rich countries did, even for the very, very poorest countries. So if you can move on to the next slide. So I've pretty well explained this, apart from the last sentence, which kind of underlines what I've just been putting. For the poor countries, those that are poor enough to actually qualify for this generosity, which is for their interest payments on their debts to be postponed by a couple of months, but they have to pay interest on that. For them to get this, they have to ask for it. But very few of them have, or at least only half of them have at the very most. And the reason why they are reluctant to ask for it is to merely ask for this, is to signal to private creditors that you are a potential credit risk. Your credit rating will actually drop if you merely ask for this generosity from the rich countries. So many of them are so scared at upsetting the private investors who are offering the money at low interest rates at the moment. They can borrow money now at a lower rate of interest than just about any time, because there's so much cash sloshing about and it can't find a place to invest that doesn't have negative interest rates in real terms once you take inflation into account. So there's a lot of money that's started flowing back into poor countries. In fact, poor countries have actually borrowed more, have broken records in 2020 for the amount of new money they've borrowed, because those that can borrow are taking advantage of extremely low interest rates. Anyway, so they must even ask for it. So if you move on. That's what happened. I thought I'd made this slide and then I couldn't find it, so I made another one. So you've already seen World Bank piled pressure onto commercial lenders. If you move on to the next slide, please. Okay, so here we have a call for the cancellation of debt of developing countries. And it just points out here that the actual total amount of debt servicing in 2020 from all developing countries, according to the calculations of these authors, 3.9 trillion. So when we take into account that those poor countries that have applied for debt relief have managed to postpone debt payments on 3.95 trillion of their debt, that's nearly 4 trillion, okay? So they've been able to postpone, 5.3 billion. They've been able to postpone $5.3 billion of debt, $5.3 billion. And the total amount of debt owed to private or public creditors by poor countries is 3.95 trillion. In other words, I'll do the maths for you. The total amount of debt relief they've so far received is 1/750th of the total debt owed by poor countries to rich countries. So that's the extent of it. It's virtually nothing. And yet what we need, we are moving into a financial crisis. a new round of debt crises. So how am I doing for time here? Let's think, because I think I've already...
Going very well for time. Take as much time as you need.
Well, in that case, I'll plough on. Okay, so if you just move on to the next slide, please. That's the picture there of Cuban doctors arriving. I don't know which country it is, I'm afraid. It could be one of many because they are present in so many countries. And before I move away from the topic of coronavirus itself completely, we have to take note, it seems to me, of one of the things that the coronavirus crisis has revealed. It's revealed a hell of a lot. And one of the things it's revealed is that we need a global health service. Not a national health service, but a global health service, that every worker, every working person, every human being on this planet should have access to basic free healthcare. That is a human right. It is a right which working people have conquered for themselves and for the rest of the world. And if we don't try and make that a reality for all workers, then we won't be able to keep it for ourselves either. And it just seems to me, I don't like, it's not, I should put it, you often hear people putting across a self-interest argument in our interest because we can't defeat the coronavirus anywhere unless we defeat it everywhere. In other words, if we could defeat it just for ourselves, then it wouldn't matter to us whether the coronavirus was raging elsewhere. So I don't like that argument, but it is actually also a fact, is that we are all human beings, and that if one person can catch something, then somebody else can catch it. So we'd better look after each other's health, just like it kind of makes sense, you know what I mean? But it's also a fundamental basic human right, and it seems to me that the only country on earth which is acting on that, on the imperative of the need for a global health service, is Cuba. If everybody did what Cuba was doing, or if the rich countries were to do what Cuba was doing, we could make rapid progress to having a global health service, to turning perhaps the World Health Organization into something that could do something 1,000 or 10,000 times more than it currently is. So, and the next slide as well. And I just think that we need to rediscover internationalism and solidarity. And I just think that we need to learn lessons from people who have practiced solidarity on a scale which has never been practiced by any people ever in history. And that is the Cuban record of internationalism is so extraordinary. And there's so much for us to learn from. I was going to include some slides about the Cuba's participation in the liberation struggles in Africa, but that would be going a little bit away from the topic. If you move on to the next slide, that's basically part one. I wanted to get across this idea of the global health emergency, economic emergency in the global south, how that is going to presages the absolute inevitability of a wave of debt crises. The World Bank itself says that this blow to Latin America is going to produce debt crisis that is deeper than the 1980s. And we'll come back to that shortly. If we can move on to on the slide now, we've got a series of graphs showing key data. Is that what it says? Okay, so just going to try and put the global crisis into a bit of perspective. I'll try and go through these as quick as possible. The first one, if you move on to the next slide. This is in many ways the number one. Treasury yields close at new lows. Now, really, the yield on 10-year Treasury bonds in the United States, that is the ultimate benchmark for global interest rates, for interest rates everywhere on this planet. It's the 10-year US Treasury bonds. They are basically considered to be risk-free. In other words, once you've removed the risk from the particular financial asset that you've invested in, this just shows what the interest rate is. And as you can see, it has been in continuous decline for several decades, inexorable decline. Not only is it inexorable decline, but it's actually now approaching zero. In fact, when you take interest rates into account, it is negative. Sorry, when you take inflation rates into account, it is negative. So it's like everything, many of these graphs, one of the things that you will see about them, the ones that are pointing downwards at any rate, not only are they trending downwards and have been for a long time, but now they seem to be reaching some sort of a limit. Like 0% is a very important limit. To go below zero has all kinds, they call it the looking glass world, it has all kinds of implications. It's not a place that you can survive in or go very far into that negative world of interest rates. Anyway, I just wanted to point it out just for the moment. We'll come back to it. There is a lot of debate about what this interest rate is, whether this interest rate is actually fixed by the US government. They're the ones who decide to sell their treasury bonds, and they fix the interest rate. But do they fix it? Because if they fix it at a price that's different from what investors are prepared to pay, they won't be able to actually realize that price. Another view, but nevertheless, governments and many economists try to give the impression that the government of the USA has some major role in deciding what the interest rate is going to be, and they've decided to have zero interest rates. Another view regards interest rates as, well, the term the natural rate, that there is a natural rate of interest, and what the government has to do is discover what it is and try and hit that rate. And if it fixes a right rate which is not the natural rate, then all kinds of bad things will happen. But the idea of the natural rate is that if you've got so much investment capital to invest, then you would look around and find places where you might be able to invest your money, and you'd make an estimate of how much your rate of return would be, let's say 5%. But you think, oh, it's quite risky here. There's a 4% chance I'll lose all my money. So that 5% interest includes a 4% risk premium, and you think you don't want to take the risk. You'd rather put your money somewhere where it was safer, where you only got 2 or 3%, but where the risk premium was much, much less. And so therefore, you would put your money into US Treasury bonds, safest place of all, or some other very safe place that had a very small risk premium. In which case, if, as we say, the only way to make sure that this money is actually being invested and not just parked in treasury bonds is for the treasury bonds to lower their price still further. And then at a certain point, your greed for some sort of return will overpower your fear that you're going to lose your stake and you will actually make the purchase. But anyway, the point is that you might say the balance of supply and demand of investment capital determines where the actual break point is, and the government tries to discover that. So it is interesting, therefore, that so many investors think there are so few places to invest their money that even at zero interest rates, they are not actually indulging in an investment boom. The Latin American countries that we looked at earlier who were borrowing money were not doing it in order to indulge in an investment boom. They were taking advantage of lower interest rates to be able to just pile up further debts and keep their economies afloat. Okay, if you move on to the next slide. So we've looked at the all-important decline of interest rates. And now we see another extremely important indicator, and that is productivity. That is, you work out how much value is supposedly generated in the average day's work. And when that figure goes up, then you've got rising productivity. And this graph here shows the trend in the percentage growth rate in GDP per hours worked. And you can see how it has been in dramatic decline for several decades, and how that decline has actually accelerated and become much more definite since the beginning of the new millennium. And the other point to bring out here again is that that decline has been going on for a long time, but it is actually approaching zero. it's actually getting to some kind of a bottom. So if you move on to the next slide, please. This here shows it's actually quite difficult to get good graphs and good data on rates of investment. But this here shows clearly the direction of net private business investment, which is on a downwards trend. If you look at the proportion of the gross domestic product of rich countries that is being reinvested in capital expenditure, you'll find that has been on another long-term decline stretching back over decades. And in fact, there's something really interesting to be found when you look at what's going on with investment in rich countries. Because even though the total amount of investment that capitalists are making has been falling, the proportion of that investment that they are making that is in so-called intangibles. It's like there's different things that they can count towards investment. And it turns out that more and more of what counts as investment these days is not in new factories and new buildings and new machines, new installations, but it is in so-called intangible capital. Research and development, which doesn't necessarily lead to actually new production. Intellectual property rights, advertising, branding, software development, lots of things which used to be counted as overheads, but now they're allowed to count as investment. And you find that more and more of what less and less investment is happening is in the so-called intangibles. That is one of the reasons why the economies have been GDP rates of growth in rich countries has been in decline, is because of the decline in investment, and that removes a whole load of demand from the economy, and only by governments or other parties going deeper into debt can that demand be replaced. Okay, so move on to the next one. This is another obviously hugely important piece of economic data, GDP growth rates. That's what you can see at the moment, yeah, GDP per capita growth. Okay, well, just to point out one or two things about this graph, it actually shows data for rich countries and poor countries, and pretty well includes the entire world. If you just concentrate for the moment on high income countries, if you were to draw a straight line, or not a straight line, if you draw a single line through that through the graph for rate of growth for rich countries, it would clearly show a downward trend. So there we have another extremely important downward trend: declining productivity growth, declining investment rates, declining rates of interest, and now we also see declining GDP. We can also see here the comparison, the contrast between low and middle income countries and high income countries, and you can see here that for most of the so-called neoliberal period from 1980 onwards up till the turn of the millennium, the dotted line, which is the per capita GDP growth for poor countries, was actually lower than in rich countries. That's taken as a whole. However, you can see that it went way above that in the first decade of the new millennium. As I say, a major factor in that was the so-called commodity super cycle. A large part of it was being stimulated by Chinese demand, which meant raw material prices went through the roof, and many poor countries that export those goods received buoyant exports for over 10 years. If we move on to the next graph, we can contrast that overall picture with the much less impressive picture for Africa compared to high-income countries as a whole. And there you can see that the Africa undershot the rich countries, already the poorest region in the world, actually experienced significantly declining at significantly lower rates of per capita growth for most of the neoliberal era. Went somewhat above it during the first 10-15 years of the new millennium. And then just to complete the picture, if we move to the next slide. And there we can see something quite dramatically different. We can see there not only what stands out is the gradual downward drift of growth in the rich countries, but we can also see how much we can see in that, in those graphs, the shifts in the center of economic gravity towards the east. The red dotted line includes China. And you can see there for all of the neoliberal era, for the last 30 years or so, per capita GDP growth in East Asia has been way above that experienced in the rich countries. And South Asia, which is the black dotted line, the weighty component of that indicates there is India. They fared much less well up till the turn of the millennium. But I rather fear that India's good times, such as they were, have already come to an end. If you move on to the next slide then. And this is kind of like the last one of this section, and it just shows what's been happening to the share of world labour income in world gross output. And this is kind of interesting as well, because if anything, you might have expected the slope to be in the other direction, from the point of view that the proportion of the population of the rich countries that actually rely on selling their labour on a wage or a salary has never been so high, something like 90%. And the proletarianization of the working population in poor countries has been continuing. And so, if you like, the number of people that are included in world labor has very much increased, and as a proportion of the global population. So on those grounds alone, the slope of that graph should be upwards, not downwards, but it just shows how much wealth is being concentrated in the hands of capitalists. So if you move on, you probably need to move through the next two to get back to that same treasury yields close at new lows. And then if you move on to the next one, it just shows another graph of the same basic thing, which is this time German government yields. And there you can see actually, even before inflation taken into account, selling bonds at negative interest rates. So we've got a picture of declining interest rates, and let's I'll just put one more picture. But if we go on to the next one, which is developing economies, trade in manufactured goods. This is a very interesting, a very contrasting graph to show alongside declining interest rates. Because one of the arguments in my book, I think, that is widely accepted as well, is that the outsourcing of production to low-wage countries and the corresponding reduction in demand for investment goods in rich countries, instead of investing in a new factory, you just shift production to a low-wage country, that has been one of the things that has resulted in a glut of investment funds. Where are you going to invest this money then if you aren't going to invest in a new factory? You don't have to build a factory in Bangladesh either, because the local capitalists there will do it for you dead cheap. And then you just have an arm's length relationship with them, so you don't need to invest either here nor there. You can invest all your money instead in on the money markets and become more and more like a financial company, even though you're supposed to be in the non-financial sector. So in many ways, the actual shift of production to low-wage countries, which you see reflected here in this graph, with their astonishing increase from just 20% to 60-70% of their total exports in the form of manufactured goods. For manufactured goods to go from 20% up to that point, it was like 4/5 of their exports were raw materials, okay? And then manufactured exports take over. And they take over so incredibly rapidly between 1980 and 1992, so like not much more than 10 years, and it triples as a share of total export from poor countries. So that was a major, had amazing development. I think one of the most important, probably the most single most transformational results or effect of neoliberalism was the massive shift of production to low-wage countries. If you move on to the next slide. Anyway, so I want you to keep in mind this idea of interest rates have been in continuous decline. Not that everybody gets access to the cheapest interest rates. The riskier you are as a potential debtor, the higher the rate of interest rate you'll be. But it's all marked up now from a negative starting point. So everybody, theoretically at least, can experience some benefit from these slightly lower interest rates. And that also includes corporations. And so one of the effects of historically low and ever lower interest rates is that corporations have been borrowing large amounts of money for different things. We'll find out what they're doing with this in a minute. So if you've got the next slide where it says global non-financial corporate debt has soared. Okay, so there you can see that shows it for several different parts of the world. The light blue line actually shows the non-financial corporate debt for so-called emerging markets. And that's really very important, as we'll see. It's been rising in all parts of the world, but it's been rising very, very significantly for the for corporations in poor countries, especially in the last 5 years. They've just piled on such a gigantic amount of debt in a short space of time. That's what happens when they get... And then if we move on to the next slide, business borrowings have soared in the US. There you can see there that this is in the United States, it's been the same story, that despite very low investment rates going on, if they're not borrowing money for investment, what are they borrowing it for? That's the interesting question. If you can see how business borrowings have soared in the USA. If we move on to the next slide, it gives a bit more information about that. Issuing vast amounts of corporate bonds. This is also despite the fact that we all may have been reading about record operating profits in the United States and all kinds of tax evasion going on. So why, if they're making record profits, they're spending so little of it on new investments and they're paying less taxes as well, why are they needing to borrow money? Well, the next slide, it gives... helps to give the answer to that. Companies favour buybacks over dividends. There's many companies in the United States in particular, but they've been doing it in Britain and Europe as well, actually borrowing money from lenders and using that cash to buy shares back from their own shareholders. So it's a different way of handing money back to shareholders. You can either hand it out in dividends or you can actually just buy the shares back. Buying the shares back has various beneficial effects for some people at any rate. It reduces the total number of shares out there, which means that you then get a concentration of profits and dividends per share. If there's less and less shares there, then the dividends go up. And so that tends to also raise the value of that particular share. So companies will go and buy shares in a company because they expect the owners of that company to buy the shares back off them in a few weeks or a few months' time, and to do so, leaving them with a nice big fat profit. So that's one of the things that low interest rates have been stimulating, not just in poor countries, but in rich countries. Companies borrowing money when they don't even need to, borrowing because they think their good times have come. Prosperity has finally arrived, which was the mirage that the high commodity prices led many third world capitalists into. Or if we look now at the next slide, it's the one that really helps to sort of, I think it's the punchline to this series of images, as soon as you can focus on it and see what you're looking at. Global creditworthiness has been eroding for 4 decades, it says, and this actually looks at the credit quality of the total amount of debt that's outstanding. So companies which are just making an average amount of profit, say $5 million a year, by borrowing money, should we say? I'll stick to this slide, just what it's showing. It's showing credit quality of corporate debt and how it's evolved. First of all, the big increase shows you how much corporate debt has been growing from as we go from left to right. And it shows as well that that which is coloured in blue, which is AAA, AA and single A, that used to be what's known as investment grade. It shows here that more than half, I think it's everything that's pink and cream and green. I've only got a tiny printout in front of me here, but a huge portion of it is actually counted as junk or non-investment grade debt. Out of the total number of companies, tens of thousands in the world, only some five or six still have a AAA credit rating. They've almost completely disappeared. So what we have is an investment universe where corporations have just piled up so much debt, even corporations that you might think were very staid and careful. By loading up on debt, they can basically convert expected future gains into high asset values today. So they're trying to realize, they're not satisfied with realizing as much profit as they can today. They want to try and capture as many future profits as they possibly can today. And that means going into debt, mortgaging their future, piling up debt. Move on to the next slide. This here shows how much that has been carried out. You saw a slide earlier on which indicated how the growth of corporate debt in emerging markets was actually much more rapid even than in other parts of the world. And here you can see in plain figures just how rapid it has been. The foreign currency debt, which is the most difficult, most dangerous debt of all, because if you're a corporation in Brazil or in Nigeria, you would be able to, if you are considered to be creditworthy enough to be able to borrow money in hard currency from a foreign bank, then you would be able to do so with paying a lower rate of interest than if you were to try and borrow the same amount of money in domestic currency from a national bank. They would very likely charge very, very much higher rates of interest. So if you can get access to hard currency interest rates from international banks, you can save yourself a hell of a lot of interest. The trouble is, when it's in foreign currency, if all of your income is in local currency and your local currency collapses, then it is exactly as if the total debt outstanding has just doubled or tripled. So there is a big risk for emerging market companies to borrow in foreign currency debt. And that is why one reason why most of it is actually in local currency debt. And as you can see, that has risen in 10 years from 4.5 trillion to 20 trillion. It has quadrupled in 10 years. And a similar sort of 500% growth in their foreign currency debt at the same time. And so, when you have a sort of a massive economic slump, the worst that's ever been recorded, inevitably reducing their incomes, it means their ability to service these debts will become, which wasn't particularly strong before, will become impossible. So we'll have a series of debt defaults. This time could well be focused on private sector companies, not sovereign governments actually defaulting, although they are all teetering on the brink as well. So I think it's possible to see how, therefore, just to sum up this, the very low rates of interest have made it possible for corporations, whether they are actually compelled to or whether they're just greedy or over-optimistic or for whatever reasons, to borrow huge amounts of money. That's been one of the effects of the low interest rates. The ability to borrow large amounts of money itself becomes a source of the value of that corporation, of that company. There is a process of financialization, if you like, that's that's taken place. If we just move now to the follow, to the next slide, global debt to GDP ratio. Let's have a little sip here. That just helps to bring the tie everything back together, because really we're looking at global debt, all the different types of debt that we've been looking at, and it just shows the enormous dizzy increase. So I want to just, I think now, bring this presentation to a conclusion, and you can move on to the next slide, please. Yeah. I've actually got probably four or five alternative conclusions, because I didn't want to have such a big conclusion. I wanted to present some facts and some ideas and some connections, and see what sort of a debate or a discussion ensued. But I'd like to just finish by just pointing out what I've been trying to do in this talk has been to underline the gravity of the situation that we're in. So many long-term trends seem to be not only continuing but accelerating, and also reaching critical points, and that is the huge increase in debt which governments have taken on in order to try and prevent an economic, a complete economic collapse, has What's clear is that all of the commentators are all agreed that the only way the huge increase in debt which governments have taken on to pile onto their already astronomical debts, the only way that we'll be able to work these off is by moving into a prolonged period of faster than average, or faster than in recent years, economic growth, a period of steady growth which has eluded capitalist economy increasingly for the last 20, 30 years. There's very, very little indication that they there's no indication whatsoever that they have the slightest chance of being able to achieve this. So there are so many indicators which point towards this crisis being, it seems to me, I think when you look at the this crisis in historical perspective, you can see how we need to go back not just 10 years to the global financial crisis, from which the global capitalist economy never properly recovered, but also to how the global financial crisis itself was prepared and shaped by the 20, 30 years which went before it. And in many ways, the extreme measures of massive increase in debt and shifting of production from rich countries to poor countries, they help to restore profitability and growth to rich countries, and therefore to the world during the neoliberal era. But they sowed the seeds for the debt crisis and the consequences of the shifting of production to low-wage countries with increasing competition. That really, it is difficult to exaggerate the scale of the crisis, because there is no obvious way out for them. And I think they realise this. I'd like to just finish. Yes, I've realised where I shall finish now. If you could go on to the, if you move on three slides to the one that begins Guyanese revolutionary Walter Rodney. Okay, that's a nice place to finish. Walter Rodney was murdered in by a bomb in, I think 40 years ago, or was it 50 years ago? Let me just think. Guyanese revolutionary Walter Rodney wrote one of his books in particular is very famous, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And just a quote from that, I think, is a good way to bring this talk to an end. Ever since the mid-19th century, Marx had predicted that class collision would come in the form of revolution in which workers would emerge victorious. However, imperialism has introduced a new factor into this situation, one that deferred the confrontation between workers and capitalists in the metropoles. I think that's a very brilliant, succinct statement by Walter Rodney. The one particular thing I want to draw out from that is from the last sentence, where he says that imperialism has introduced a new factor that has deferred the confrontation between workers and capitalists in the metropoles. So imperialism has deferred the confrontation between workers and capitalists in the metropoles. That confrontation is coming. It's been deferred for a long time. This crisis means that the old way of living for the imperialist countries cannot continue, and that they are being forced to tear up the social contract which has paralyzed working class internationalism in the rich countries over the past 50-100 years. And I just think that it's been so difficult to come to terms with what has happened to us since the global financial crisis and since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, that we haven't even begun to give a moment's thought to what is coming down on us, what we need to prepare for, because this is the deepest crisis that capitalism in its several centuries of existence has ever faced. We have to go back to pre-World War One and pre-World War Two times to find anything comparable. And we all know how those periods ended. So I've been convinced for quite some time that the post-World War Two world that I've lived in for most of my life and that you've lived in for most of your lives has definitively come to an end, and that we are, if anything, in what we should see as the pre-World War Three world. I'm not trying to make out that world war is inevitable, but it certainly is inevitable unless working people take power out of the hands of those who are so misusing it. And on that note, I'll finish. Thank you.
Thanks a million, John, for that absolutely excellent presentation, extremely comprehensive, offers an awful lot of knowledge and information to reflect on as well as to study. A very good companion, a very worthy companion to your book on imperialism. I suppose we can spend, a brief minute or two just sort of examining the trajectory of capitalism through this crisis. What do you think is the pressing need for the workers' movement in the global north to take in solidarity with workers in the global south who are fighting against the process of super exploitation?
Well, I think this conversation, this question, I find it very, very stimulating to think about it in a slightly reword it. And that is, let's put it like this. What would you put into a communist manifesto for the 21st century? If a communist manifesto was being rewritten for these times, what should go into it? Why the hell aren't we writing this document? Maybe we are writing it. It's something that we're going to have to discover. I think that in many ways, the closest thing I could think of to the Communist Manifesto is the first and second declaration of Havana. And the Cuban revolutions, in many ways, they actually wrote a sort of a Communist Manifesto for their purposes. And amazing pieces, amazing documents. And they're basically just identifying what are the problems that the people are facing and what practical solutions or what measures are we going to take to address them. So if we'd say, what should workers be doing? It's we have to, well, it's obvious, isn't it, really? We have to act in our own interest, not in somebody else's. We have to act in our own interest. What are our own interests? It seems to me that people are drawn to the socialist movement and the communist movement and the workers' movement. I think by maybe there are many different reasons, but one big reason is that we are drawn to this movement because it is opposed to all forms of oppression and discrimination on the principle that anything which violates the unity and equality of working people, we are against. So we are in favour of eliminating and combating everything which interferes with and harms the unity and the equality of working people. That, it seems to me, is the sort of what's in the interest of our class, that is. And if we actually look at what it is, what is harming and violating the equality and unity of working people, we can see there are different things. One is gender, very important. The unity and equality of working people is seriously damaged by gender inequality. And the not just low pay for women who are actually at work, but the fact that women's domestic labour is totally unpaid and unrecognised. But and then we can say there is racial division. And sure, there, that is a source of weakness and disunity, of course, especially when when workers of different races and colours are forced into competition with each other. But in many ways, the biggest of all, the deepest of all, is the division created by imperialism. Which part of the world you happen to be living in, which country you happen to be born in, that will determine whether you're going to be relatively highly paid or relatively crap paid. I know these people who receive terrible wages in rich countries, but even the barista in London is far better than the coffee farmer. So therefore, if socialists are all about trying to combat every source of inequality, imperialism has to be the number one priority for socialists, because that is the source of the number one, the deepest inequalities. And that the struggle for socialism is nothing else than the struggle to overcome the huge differences in life chances and potential that people have in different parts of the world, to overcome the legacy of imperialism, to consciously combat this enormous obstacle to our unity. So that's the basic principle that I think would underline the Communist Manifesto for the 21st century. But just to say one or two practical things, I think we've already touched on one, the Global Health Service, that we need to try and emulate what Cuba's doing. We need to be in favour of everything that points towards a free, globally coordinated, non-mercenary healthcare system for the planet. Another one would be that it's not difficult at all to calculate the living wage, what it costs, what it would take, what it would cost for a worker and his or her family to pay basic for their basic nutritional needs, healthcare, access to education, a little bit else, a little bit on top of that perhaps, for their what you call a fair living wage. There are calculations that have been done for Bangladesh, for instance. The Asian Floor Wage Alliance, calculates that Bangladeshi textile garment workers receive approximately one-fifth of what would be needed to pay for a basic minimum basket of consumption goods in Bangladesh. But it'd be quite easy for the trade union movement and the International Labour Organization and anybody else to actually calculate what a basic living wage would be for working people in every different country. And then it would be the campaign for the trade union should campaign to try and create the conditions for everybody to achieve that. And I think as well, one final one I'll mention, but there are others, would be that there are still 1,000 million people on this planet who don't have access to electricity, and that is an urgent thing. And it's also vital that they manage to get their electricity without actually having to connect up to some petrochemical burning coal-fired power station in order to get their electricity. Technology currently exists for all that's needed for a medium-sized village to be put on the back of a single trailer and assembled as a solar panel instant solar power generator. We have the technology for that, and we should demand. Well, it was very interesting with the after the Kyoto summit in 1997, a lot of money flowed into solar power panels in Germany, in the United States, and other countries, because they thought there'd be lots of government money going in that direction to try and meet climate targets. But then China came on the scene, and within a very short space of time, China managed to grab 90% of the global market in the production of solar panels. And all of the capitalists who'd invested in solar panel production in Germany and in the United States, and most of the workers who were employed in them, lost their jobs and their money. But and then it turned out that they were even overproducing solar panels in China, and the first private corporate bond to go bust in China was a solar panel manufacturer who couldn't service his debts. And I thought that's the crazy way for capitalism to proceed, to have massive overproduction and busts and factories being driven out of production in Germany and the United States, when they could have been kept in production making bloody solar panels for the millions of people around the world who need this stuff. And if that had been done on a non-capitalist basis through a workers' plan and demanding funding via the United Nations to actually finance it on the grounds and actually put that plan together and say, we will do it in 5 years. Or, you know, I mean, I think it'd be quite, maybe 10 years, but in a realistic short space of time, a major, major problem confronting humanity could be overcome. And it could be a symbol of intention, a statement of intention. That's the sort of thing that can go into a communist manifesto for the 21st century, which has to be an action program, not a theoretical text.
Thanks very much, John. An awful lot to reflect on there. It highlights the nature of anti-imperialism. And as we say in the Irish language, Ibraha agus a phobla cloita na nuila here, corrigi le hela, or as is more familiar in English, Workers of the World Unite. You can pick up a copy of John's book in Connolly Books on our website in 43 East Essex Street. An absolutely must read for anyone looking to take on these questions. Next week we will have on a fellow Marxist economist, Michael Roberts, who will further develop some of the ideas explored today and be a great complement to John's work. So John, many thanks for your presentation and a brief discussion tonight, and to our audience as well. So thank you very much, and we hope to see you on the barricades.
Okay, well, thank you all. Greetings to all of you. I should have learned a bit of Irish for this event. My mother is from County Mayo, as it happens, and I've got many happy memories and have been out there in the past. But yeah, and also give my greetings to Michael next week. But thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Sandra.